Do you like being on show?
On my show?
No, do you like being on show like this, like being trotted out and displayed?
Oh, I don't care. I mean, you know, having been a heroin addict is really good training for going with our career in the entertainment business, because you know, anytime you think, wow, this is really undignified or humiliating, you just, you know, I think back of, you know, borrowing money from my mom under false pretenses, or, you know, stealing purses on the subway or selling my stuff on the street. So it's, you know, undignified compared to what, you know? It's nice to know how low you were willing to go before you get into television.
Hi, I'm Robert Wemet, and this is Wemet Presents Episode 2. On this episode, I'm going to open up the podcast vault. Well, it's actually a hard drive sitting on the shelf, but vault sounds a bit more impressive. On that hard drive is a podcast I did in 2006 with the late chef and author Anthony Bourdain when he was in Vancouver to promote his book, The Nasty Bits. At the time, podcasting was not exactly a household word, but the internet marketing director at Rinko's Books was a very forward-thinking woman named Monique Sheridan. Hi, Monique.
Hello.
So, cast your mind back to 2006.
Yes.
I know, right? So, you were at Rinko's Books. Now, you were in charge of internet marketing at Rinko's.
My title was internet marketing manager. I think there were two of us in Canada in publishing with that title at the time.
I know. You were one of the early people in publishing who really jumped on the internet.
Totally, yes. I was a big fan.
So I just want to talk to you a little bit about the Anthony Bourdain podcast, which was part of a series that Raincoast did, but I also want to put it into some context. So it's 2006, end of 2005, beginning of 2006, when you and I talked about, or you asked me if I would help do these.
Yes.
In 2006, I looked this up, there were less than 10,000 podcasts on iTunes in 2006. Today, there's 650,000. I mean, podcast.
We were the first Canadian publisher to podcast.
Exactly, and podcasting had really only started like 3 years earlier, so it was still pretty new.
Well, hey, Facebook had only launched in 2004, YouTube 2005. So it was those were early days.
So how hard was it for you to float this idea at your company to do podcasts as a marketing tool?
Well, to Raincoast credit, they gave me quite a long leash. So I had lobbied to have that position as internet marketing manager, coming from their catalog and marketing division, very old school traditional marketing tactics within the publishing industry, print-based marketing. And what I had sold them on was this idea of having a mix of online tools and tactics. The website became one of them, ways to digitize the catalog and put it online, very pre-Amazon, which quickly came along and took over that space. The blog was an addition to that. There was no Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, really, in at that time. So the podcasting became the next piece of the puzzle, and then the social media fell after that.
I mean, you said, and to Raincoast's credit, that they gave you lots of room to move and do this. But I mean, from my perspective, I'm also still quite struck by the fact that you gave me complete freedom. Like, you didn't vet any questions I was going to ask people. You didn't insist on, like, designing what I was going to do. You let me do whatever I wanted to do, which is, when I think about it, is, like, incredible.
Well, one, I had a lot of confidence in your experience and background, and I was hiring you to be an expert in doing that. But I always felt like we had a good shared vision in terms of what needed to come out of that. We wanted to tell a good story, and you were an expert at that.
Yeah, well, thanks. Here's the other brilliant thing. So you phoned me and said that Anthony Bourdain was going to be in town, and how about me just tagging along with them when Anthony was going to go do his media appearances and somehow do a podcast there?
And I know.
It was incredibly smart, because what a
I mean, it was the most, it was the best way to interact with him and to learn about him, because here he was going about his day and there was no sit down and talk to Robert. It was like, just, we'll talk as the day progresses.
I know. I wanted that behind the scenes. He's such a character, and it was a great way to capture that. And I'm always like, when you're saying that, I'm thinking, wow, the things that people let me get away with.
No kidding. But it was brilliant, though, Monique. I think you have to take credit for the fact that it was the smartest possible treatment that you could have come up with.
Oh, that's very kind. Thank you.
Well, and also for him, because he, you know, he had his TV show. He was obviously a star of the media. He had done everything, been there, done that. And this was different enough that he kind of had fun doing it.
Yeah, I think all of the guests had fun. I mean, people think they're going to have some crazy, slick studio experience, and that creates a lot of anxiety. And you would show up with your mic and kitchen and an office chair. And that really put people at ease.
Well, I think the thing for me that I, thanks, and what I appreciate about the Bourdain piece particularly was that I loved all the activity that was going on around us as we talked. And I just loved hearing all that activity, the car doors and the coming and going and the people laughing in the background, and the, just because it also gave you the context of what was actually going on. It wasn't that sort of fake, sterile studio.
Yeah. And that has since become the angle that most podcasts, TV shows, the sort of like behind the scenes making of, people like that sort of thing, right? It kind of pulls away the magic curtain.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important because we do live in a world where so much is made up.
True.
So thank you so much for catching up.
You're very welcome. Thank you for calling.
And we'll talk soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, Robert.
That's Monique Sherritt, who now runs a company called Boxcar Marketing here in Vancouver. So, now on to the podcast. I was super excited about it, but also very nervous about the whole thing. I expected a high-maintenance, demanding star, and now I'm not really sure why I thought that. I just thought, oh, this is going to be really tense. We had an early morning start. I was told to meet the publicist and Anthony at his hotel in downtown Vancouver at 7. As usual, I showed up early. And at 6:40, there in the lobby, was the other early guy, Anthony Bourdain. And he was the nicest, most accommodating guest I've worked with in a long time. I told him I wanted to put a wireless body mic on him for the day. He didn't bat an eye. He just raised his hands up so I could run the mic cable inside his shirt and helped me tuck the transmitter into his back pocket. And through the course of the day, he kept checking with me to see if the batteries needed changing or if we needed to make any adjustments. I mean, he was just the most polite, easiest guy to work with. The day was busy. We went to radio and TV stations where he was hustled in, interviewed, and then we'd hustle back out, jump in the car, drive to the next place, and repeat through the day. And all the while, he and I would chat. We ran the podcast as a three-part series. I'll be playing all three parts here today together, and where necessary, I'll jump in and explain the context for each section you're going to hear. So, here now, from the podcast originally released in July of 2006 for Raincoast Books in Vancouver, I'm happy to present my day with Anthony Bourdain. So do you ever get any questions that surprise you anymore?
In Japan, it's really weird, okay, because they're, what is appropriate and inappropriate are different. So, you know, to have this very shy, sort of giggly Japanese female journalist saying, ah, so Bourdain-san, and what is your favorite color? Blue. And how big is your penis? So, it's like, that shocked me. But this wasn't kooky crazy. This was like a, you know, legitimate interview, and there's what is appropriate and inappropriate is different there. Also, the segue was a little alarming, you know? Every once in a while, you'll get just a really provocative one where someone's clearly looking for you to say something outrageous.
And you don't do that on purpose.
Yeah. I mean, I generally see it coming, you know? Somebody's looking for me to slag Jamie Oliver, you know? But generally, oh, okay, sure.
Or Woody Harrelson, I guess.
Well, that doesn't take any prompting.
Do you like being on show?
On my show?
No, no. Do you like being on show like this, like being trotted out and displayed?
I don't care. I mean, you know, having been a heroin addict was really good training for going with our career in the entertainment business because, you know, anytime you think, wow, this is really undignified or humiliating, you just, you know, I think back of, you know, borrowing money from my mom under false pretenses or, you know, stealing purses on the subway or selling my stuff on the street. So it's, you know, undignified compared to what, you know? It's nice to know how low you were willing to go before you get into television.
That's very, I mean, that's a really profound notion, though, that, you know, you're a media star, but as you say, nothing is quite as demeaning as other things you've been through. And do you find that as you're going through these various things that you're doing television shows all over the world, you're meeting all sorts of people, you're encountering every day all these bizarre circumstances that, you know...
I'll answer this way. It's like, I always like to keep, you know, sort of foremost in my mind the very real possibility that I'm wrong, maybe even about everything. I'm grateful for the fact that when you travel a lot, especially, you know, I mean, I had a fairly sheltered existence in a kitchen for all those years, so it was, you know, it's all new to me over the last 5-6 years to be able to travel. The thing about travel, you're forced to learn, you know, just to like feed yourself breakfast in a country where you don't speak the language, you know, takes a certain amount of, you know, often painful acquisition of knowledge, meaning it's embarrassing to get it wrong in Japan, you know, when you walk into a place, it's all Japanese, the signs are in Japanese, you don't speak, obviously, the language, it's sort of, you know, point and smile. You know, so it's fun sometimes being wrong. It's fun overcoming one's fear of humiliating oneself, or looking silly or awkward, or, you know, or just being, you know, wrong about a place or a people or you know, something you absolutely believe. You know, that happens to me all the time. You know, I honestly believed absolutely that New York was the center of the world when I, you know, and then I went to Beijing and Tokyo and Singapore, and you're thinking, well, you know, if it is, it, you know, it won't be for much longer.
And the thing that you learn when you take those chances or discover that you're wrong are pretty interesting, aren't they?
I don't know. I mean, compared to what? You know, I don't want to make myself sound like, you know, I'm in the special forces or something. I mean, I'm living pretty large. You know, I sleep on a fair amount of, you know, bare ground or, you know, long houses, boats, planes. But, you know, on the other hand, I also spend a fair amount of time in nice hotels. So, you know, chances, you know, the most dangerous thing that I face most of the time is a bout of diarrhea and projectile vomiting.
Thank you very much for stopping by and chatting with us. It is 7:55. You're watching Breakfast Television.
Okay, so we got all sorts of questions from the internet.
Yeah.
Sherry in Kempville, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Most interesting gross Canadian dish you have tried?
Raw seal eyeball or brain.
And?
Kind of hard. Quite delicious. I mean, like sushi. Pretty terrifying looking.
I was going to say.
The taste was much better than it looked.
Because to put an eyeball in your mouth has got to take an act of faith.
It's sort of like a Concord grape, only fishier.
I don't know if I could do the eyeball.
Yeah, you could. Eyeball, it's so last week. You know, I mean, been there, done that, yeah.
Amber of Saskatoon, which country do you find has the most diverse food culture?
Diverse? Probably America, because you know, New York City, there's no such thing as America. We're just a place that people from someplace else come. I mean, it's our greatest strength is that we're a nation of immigrants, so a lot of whom bring their supply train and their dishes and their cuisine. I mean, you know, Queens, New York, that's what country has the most diverse cuisine.
Jen in the Chicago suburbs wants to know how you stay so slim.
Cigarettes, neurotic personality, fidgeting. An unhealthy lifestyle.
You know, actually, she said more than that. She said she wants to know how you stay so slim and so handsome.
Oh, well, shucks, thanks.
Okay, and I've got one more here. Have you ever got ill from the food you've tried? And you've written about this, that sometimes does happen.
I've only been, you know, poisoned to the point of, you know, needing medical assistance, immediate medical assistance once in France, of all places. You know, every once in a while you spin the wheel, it comes up 00, and you spend a little quality time on a cold bathroom floor. Africa was not good to me, but no, nothing that really took me out of the game. You know, the only time I missed a day's work was in France.
And what was the food?
3-day-old tête de veau, way too much foie gras, and too much sauterne first thing in the morning. I don't know which of those did it, but it was total system shutdown. You know, shock, chills, sweats, you know, I needed medical assistance. I needed a house call.
Now, do you have a food that if you're just, you wake up and you're hungry, is there something that you always fall to that is your fave?
Any time of day?
Yeah.
Oh, God, no, it depends. I mean, and sushi, I'm always ready for sushi. Good sushi. A utility sushi, when you've been to Japan and you've eaten at Masa, utility sushi will no longer do. You know, it's got to be good. Warm, crumbly rice, not too cold fish. Aged just right, you know, it should, fresh sushi, the freshest sushi is not necessarily the best sushi. However, people might like to delude themselves that that is the case. And of course, I love a good pastrami sandwich. You know, I tend to get sentimental about it because I don't get an opportunity to have a good deli, you know, when I'm traveling. It's something I miss.
The other thing as I was reading Nasty Bits, that because I worked as a busboy when I was a kid, mm-hmm. Never worked in a restaurant. Yet, all of the stuff you talk about in terms of the work ethic and the approach to work and the idea of getting up and really applying yourself, I think applies to almost any profession, anybody who wants to get ahead.
I think it's no accident that Chinese and Indians are going to be the workforce of the future. The managerial class are going to run the IT industry, our future masters, because they have a good work ethic. Show up on time, you know, do the best job you can. You know, that's not a lot to ask in any workplace, but apparently it's too much for a lot of us.
Well, I know that, I think one of the things you said that really resonated with me was the idea that there is no job that isn't my job.
Right.
You know, we need to get this done.
Right.
And there is no room for that's not my job.
Yeah. Especially in the restaurant business. You know, you can pretend to put on airs in the dining room, but, you know, when the grease trap blows up, you know, you're not cooking until it's fixed. So you may as well take a hand. I'd love to live in a socialist agrarian, you know, wonderland, think like the French, nice month-long vacation, and, you know, I need my nice long lunch, but, you know, I'll be unemployed. You know, that's the future is for those who are willing to work hard and with a single-minded dedication to being good, or to be, maybe even being the best. At least being, you know, taking work seriously. And I just don't, I look down on, frankly, they tell me how much vacation they get in Europe, and, you know, calling in sick. I mean, that's unthinkable to me, you know. It's really sad when you see culinary students, you know, they've left a perfectly good job in, you know, the financial sector, or, you know, they think, oh, it's glamorous, it's good, it's going to live out my dream of opening a bread and breakfast by going to culinary school, spending all that money, all that time, work a little bit in New York and in some busy restaurants to get my chops, and then I'll open the bed and breakfast of my dreams. You see these people come in. You know, you put them to work, and, you know, first Saturday night, you look across the line, you know, their face, and you see in their eyes, you watch the dream die. You know, they realize people aren't nice here. This is hard. It's unglamorous. It's ooky. That's why I recommend that people who are thinking of culinary school, you know, go to work before you spend the money. Go to work in a restaurant as a dishwasher, as a prep cook. See if you're really cut out for the business. You know, people who like that kind of heat and pressure and madness, they're not normal people. You know, so maybe you're not right for the business. Find out before rather than later.
Hey, who you work hard. You know, as much as you say the writing the books and the travel is not as hard as working the restaurant, and obviously I believe you, but you work hard. You don't have to work this hard if you don't want to.
I feel lucky. I am lucky. I know I'm lucky.
Like,
I make a living writing. How few people pull that off?
And who do you want to most impress? Like, who?
I just want cooks, the cooks and restaurant people who read my books. I just, as long as they say, you know, that's not bullshit, I'm happy. That's enough for me.
You're listening to a podcast originally released in 2006 with Anthony Bourdain. The second part of the podcast was centered around Anthony's visit to do a book signing at Barbara Jo's Books to Cooks. That's a bookstore run by Barbara Jo McIntosh in Vancouver that sadly is no longer open. We'll pick up the podcast with our arrival at the bookstore. We had to park in the back because there was a huge lineup of people in the front, and Barbara Jo met us in the parking garage, and we kind of secretly went up this back series of stairs and doors and hallways and stuff. And we'll pick things up with Anthony explaining to a journalist that was with us why he thinks it's fine for people who don't cook to spend tons of money on kitchens and barbecues.
I completely understand the, you know, fetishize knives and really nice pots and pans and, you know, really incredible ovens. You know, I like to use the sushi example. Suddenly in America, everyone, you know, there was a tipping point where people suddenly decided that eating raw fish, something that was previously repellent to them, was a good thing. Now, however, maybe they did it because it was cool, because it looked pretty, because they saw someone they liked to eat it on TV. They read Shogun. It doesn't matter. The fact is, when they started eating sushi, everything got better for chefs everywhere. I mean, expectations for fish in Italian and French restaurants got better. So,
here's your chair.
Who cares how it got there or why?
Thanks.
Oh, and along with the chair, an ice cold beer.
Oh, man. What kind of person do you think I am? An alcoholic.
These people have been here since 7:15, Tony.
Oh, my God.
They got here before I did.
Hi.
So why don't you start?
Okay. Chef, how you doing?
So well.
All good.
Well, we had Anthony here in 2004 when he brought out Lahell's The Cookbook, and we had such a great time with him then, and his time was very limited in Vancouver this trip, so we planned the event at the Yale Hotel, which went great, but I knew that I wanted to have him in the store, so I said to Rain Coast Books, well, I need him. So they said, okay, well, you can have him at 8 o'clock for 1 hour in the morning, and I said, I'll take him. People feel that his voice is speaking to them from a very honest place, somebody that I think one of his lines that he, you know, you hear him say over and over again about his drug addiction was that he wanted to live, that he, you know, made a lot of people unhappy, and I think people really can relate to that, because I think over our lives we've all made somebody unhappy along the way, and to hear somebody come out and say it, so I think that it comes from there, and then he's been able to write in that voice for everyone to appreciate.
I was showing you his restaurant across the street from.
Oh yeah.
And they're off.
Sorry to put you through the monotony of same.
I hate selling books.
Yeah, I'm sure. This is a bunch of
Josh
chefs that are going to. They're all going to New York.
Yeah, I'm gonna get a Papaya King hot dog.
Papaya King hot dog?
Oh yeah, the one on East 86th.
Okay.
Where to go? Barney Greengrass, the Sturgeon King, is good too on Amsterdam and 86th.
Barney Greengrass and Sturgeon King.
Typical New York Jewish breakfast. Okay. It's fantastic.
Right on. How long in our lovely city for?
Just a few more hours.
Oh, really?
Then off to Seattle.
Yeah. It's a good one.
I actually got up at 6. I'm a big fan. Loved Cook's Tour. That's what got me out of the country, actually, to go to Asia. And, I just think he's a great writer and great on television.
It's a mix. Young, aspiring chefs, culinary students, working cooks, restaurant people, foodies, former restaurant people who kind of miss it, and a growing contingent of Asians who just, you know, really like, who a lot of times, Vietnamese emigres or second-generation Vietnamese, Chinese, Malaysian, Singaporean, who haven't been home, who've never been to their parents' home country, or who emigrated some time ago and are homesick, as well as a lot of, you know, recent arrivals who just kind of dig it that, you know, this goofy American guy loves their food and writes about it enthusiastically. That's really changed over the last few years. I mean, I've just noticed more and more Asian readers and viewers. Obviously, I like that, you know. I like being liked in Asia because I like I like going there. I can use all the friends I can get in that part of the world.
All right, thanks, dude.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Enjoy.
Hi, how you doing?
I have a sip of that. You probably need it. I thought you might start with the beer this morning.
A little early even for me.
My wife is, really enjoyed the show last night.
Well, thank you.
So you're going to keep the show going for a long time, we hope?
As long as they let me.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, they've renewed for a third season, so. Toloretta also, yep. All of these?
Yeah.
He just doesn't seem like your usual kind of cookbook author or food author. I'm surprised that this is at 8 o'clock. I figure he probably hasn't gone to bed yet. But maybe that's just the reputation he wants to cultivate.
Well, thanks. You guys have a fun time in Vancouver?
Always.
Yeah? Are you guys out and about last night?
Hanging out with some chefs, eating barbecue.
Oh, yeah? Oh.
Okay, speaking of barbecue, this is my world famous tequila lime sauce.
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
You can take that with you?
I will.
That'd be awesome.
Thank you very much. Can I get a picture of you?
Yeah.
Let's get
one. Sure.
Okay. The Kitchen Confidential kind of got us started on them because it's authentic. It's real. It's real kitchen.
Is your hand getting tired?
Nah. A lot easier than tourneying carrots.
You're okay?
Hello.
Hi. It's not, this is for you.
Oh,
just
thank you.
I just said that you support the Mexicans, and I am Mexican.
Yeah, I'm right. Where are you from
in
Mexico?
I'm from Guadalajara.
Guadalajara. I haven't been there. Good food?
No? Oh, thank you.
Yeah?
Good pozole.
Oh, I love pozole. And menudo, I like a lot.
Si?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I have a question. Why do you decide to help the Mexicans? Why you become your house?
Because I work, because Mexicans have to, you know, helped me and worked with me and worked for me and shown me how to survive in the kitchen for over 20 years. Because who are the best cooks in New York? You know, when I was new in the kitchen and they say, here's how you learn your job, it was always I learned from a Mexican guy. Mi carnales. Right? And always just a couple of Mexicans who
Seattle area.
Who are, you know, who like that, you know, somebody's actually talking about Mexican cooks. Well, at least acknowledging the fact that, you know, they're doing all the cooking in America, or much of it. That the restaurant business is so entirely dependent on them. And that's something that mainstream food press, you know, deliberately ignore. I mean, they know it, and they I'm not going to say lie, but they pretend not to see. Now, it's easier to peg an article, hang an article on, you know, the celebrity chef, and pretend that he's there. It's disgusting. It's really disgusting. You know, sophisticated, knowledgeable, you know, politically liberal, writers in New York City who perpetuate that whole, you know, this whole myth. You know, it's hard, even, you know, guys who would like to, I mean, as far as the Mexican component, Latino component, you know, if you don't have a big successful TV show or a publishing empire behind your restaurant, it is very much in your financial interest to keep that mystique going, you know, that there is a laying on of hands on every dish by the, you know, the famous chef. That's, you know, you kind of need that, especially because they're very aware that the press will jump all over them if they're seen kind of out and about too much, and if people come to think that they're not in their place enough, that they've moved on, they're not paying attention.
It's his birthday coming up.
Yeah.
Yes, 50.
So we'll say happy birthday.
It's your birthday coming up. Number 50.
Okay. Yeah.
Have a good birthday.
Thank you. I honestly never thought I'd see 30 or 40. I mean, I was kind of really confused after, particularly after 30. I was like, well, Jesus, what do I do now? I didn't have a plan. So really, I kind of got used to the fact that I don't have a plan, and that plan seems to have been working. At this point, I just feel like, you know, I've compared it to a pinball game, where you're kind of drunk at a bar, and you drop a quarter in a pinball machine, and you really tend to lose the quarter quickly. You know, yeah, I'll just play for a few minutes, finish my beer, and go home. And for some reason, maybe because you're drunk, maybe because you don't care, you know, the thing keeps racking up extra points, like ding, 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 bonus, 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 and you know, you're beginning to wonder, you know, when do I get the hell out of here? I never expected to live to 30. It came as a real shock to me, you know. So I just see as like I'm on bonus round.
Beauty. Thank you.
From the book signing at Barbara Jo's Books to Cooks in Vancouver, that's Anthony Bourdain from a podcast we did in 2006. And the last installment of the podcast started with me asking a question about what, if anything, chefs from around the world have in common.
Well, I mean, I think working chefs who are famous for their food, right, and not for necessarily for a TV show, you know, guys like Eric Rappaire or, you know, most of the French, Daniel Boulud, yeah, they are very similar, meaning, you know, we're all very comfortable hanging out together and talking about food. You know, however you may present yourself to the dining room or in public, as far as attitude and you know, self-importance, there's no lying among chefs. Everybody pretty much knows their, you know, how good they are or limited they are, and they certainly, it's more of a blue collar, you know, it's just like firemen hanging out after work or construction workers, except, you know, we're eating and drinking really, really well and talking about food. Chefs all over the world, you know, whether I've met them or not, we all kind of end up having the same conversation. And then we certainly share a lot of character traits. Shy people, generally. I mean, or they're protecting a soft core. You know, socially dysfunctional. You know, that's what's very comforting about the hierarchy of the kitchen is, you know, you've built yourself a fairly rigid, safe world. You know, filled with pointy objects. But I mean, you're given enough time there. You know how to work those levers. You know, we're less sure of ourselves, or most chefs certainly are less sure of themselves, you know, among real people, you know, trying to, like, you know, have normal human relationships or, you know, conduct business in the you know, the regular non-restaurant business community. That's hard, you know, and I think a lot of people are instinctively shy of that kind of contact or that kind of, this kind of relations.
You're on the road almost constantly now. Do you miss being in the kitchen?
I miss sitting at the bar after a busy shift, feeling like on top of the world, you know, and hanging out with my cooks, knowing I put in a really busy night. But the work, standing on my feet 14 hours a day, no, I don't miss it. I had 30 years of it. I mean, I should probably lie. Oh, yes, I really miss it. I, you know, it's my heart, it's my soul. 30 years I had. It's a lot of knee bends.
Is there stuff you don't do? Like you like to try stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But is there stuff you just, like, are you afraid of heights or you don't ride a bike?
I'm afraid of karaoke. dancing in public, you know? I'm way past the age where any sensible person should have to see that. I'm afraid of clowns and nurses' shoes and rats. So won't be eating rat. I don't care how delicious some might believe them to be. I'm afraid of, like, you know, mediocrity. Like, that terrifies me. Like, to, you know, I don't want to be mediocre, and I'm terrified when there's a lot of mediocrity. When I seem to be surrounded by, you know, people who are being deliberately mediocre. You know, Paris Hilton scares the hell out of me. Because, you know, she makes a living by pretending to be even more stupid, vapid, and useless and untalented than she is, and is rewarded for it. That seems to be a career for a lot of people on these reality shows. I find that frightening.
There's a recurring theme in the Nasty Bits about the work ethic, and that really the restaurant business isn't for everybody.
I think if you're used to if you're used to being on time every day, never calling in sick, you know, any kind of hard work prepares you for other businesses. Certainly writing books and talking about myself on television is a lot easier. I never complain about that because, you know, I know what work is. I would say that the same is true of rice farming. You know, if you come from a rice, if you grew up in a rice farming family in Vietnam and you get the opportunity to go to MIT, you're not complaining about your workload. You know what work is. You know what hunger is. And you know the caprices and perils of, you know, bad luck. It's something that makes Latino immigrants a more attractive option for a lot of chefs in New York because they come from a place where it's hard. They know what hard work is. It's a character issue. They know what it's like to be part of a family and be responsible for other people from a culture where food is important, where even if you do everything right, things can go terribly wrong. You know, if you listen to Mexican folk music, you know, it's all about tragedy, rejection, misfortune, and yet they find beauty or humor in those things. A lot of times a spoiled American kid, you know, he'll see the boss cutting back on kitchen staff, pinching pennies on the same day he buys a Porsche, then an expensive new girlfriend, and that's a soul-destroying moment for him. He just can't handle that kind of unfairness, whereas most of the people in the world understand that unfair is, you know, we live in a very unfair, harsh world where, one day of bad weather can wipe out a year's work, where you call the police to come, you know, you call the police and they rob you again. That makes for good restaurant help.
You also talk a lot about how the kitchen's really a great leveler.
There's no lying in the restaurant business, okay? You walk in, you talk a good game, you flash a great resume. Everybody knows within 5 minutes. Everyone knows everything about you. Within a few days, you spend so much time together. It's a very intimate workplace. I mean, it's the last meritocracy where men and women can speak to each other honestly. The level of discourse is completely politically incorrect, and even some moronic. But your worth, your value as a coworker, as a human being, is dependent entirely on your performance on the job. What other place exists that is like that, where you can be however nice or disgusting as you choose, but you are judged by where you are when the chips are down? You say my knife works great. Well, we'll find out in seconds. I mean, a lot of chefs, when you first come into their kitchen, it's like, oh yeah, make me an omelet. I know everything about you. By the time you finish that omelet, I know everything there is to know. You know, I not only know if you can really cook as you say you can, I know if you're a liar. I know if you're, you know.
Did you say you've learned more about human nature from the restaurant business or from being on the road?
Yeah, I think travel. You get however useful and wonderful working in the restaurant business is, it's a pretty narrow view of the world. You don't see much of the real world. It's a subculture. However international that subculture, it's still, when you get out in the real wide world and you see people with real problems from a variety of different countries and cultures, I take a more charitable view of the basic goodness of humanity having traveled than, you know, I tended before to look at the public as, you know, hungry and capricious, and maybe not so good when things get tough. That's changed. When you see, you know, when you go to Vietnam, it's hard to come back cynical.
Now you've stuck with food all this time.
I like eating. I like all of the great things that come with traveling and or just eating in interesting places. Of taking the time to, you know, drive an extra mile or you know, take a chance on something you haven't had before. I mean, it's fun. It feels good. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. I mean, I feel bad for food critics, for instance, who burn out. You know, they've been writing fun with mayonnaise articles for so long, or, you know, the latest little crummy bistro in their community, and, you know, it bleeds all the joy out of the experience. You know, they go loping off to the latest restaurant already angry and hating it because it's probably going to be just like the other restaurant they were at. I mean, if that's the way you feel, you should stop doing it. You know, do something useful.
There are people who just eat out at fast food restaurants or the sort of chain restaurants. What advice have you got for them?
Stop, for God's sake. If at all possible, you know, find an ethnic neighborhood in your community and eat there. Cook for yourself. Just, you know, there's more to this world. You're it's bad enough getting fat, but getting fat on bad food, what a waste. You know, food's fun. Food's important. Food feels good, or it should. You know, the best you can say about those restaurants is you won't be hungry when you're done eating there. You may as well eat styrofoam. In fact, you might well be. Find a foodie, befriend them, and let them take you by the hand and feed you well. You know, finding good food isn't that hard. You know, it's a lot like finding drugs. You know, find others with similar appetites and follow them to their source.
You completely slam the idea of British pubs going gourmet in a chapter in the book called The Drinking Problem.
Oh yeah, no, I've reevaluated my position. No, that I like to think it's a funny piece, and I was initially outraged to see the introduction of good food in high-end food in a pub. But I've since been back and eaten some very decent food. They seem to have settled down, and more often than not are serving pretty authentic, good stuff with a reasonable scope of ambition. You know, there's nothing wrong with some decent food along with your pint of Guinness. I did a commentary in the back of Nasty Bits because, you know, on rereading, I was wrong about some things or was silly.
So you made a reference to getting your first tattoo. Have you got any more?
Yeah. I have a knife on my back with a little drop of blood on it. A little band here that was my first. I got one in Borneo in Malaysia of a snake eating its own tail at Ebon one, and I was just on Miami Inc. as part of a cross-promotional thing for the network where they, so I was on the show and they got a skull. I was very affected by this tribe in the Ebon in Borneo who are into, you know, as you accumulate experiences, you commemorate that somehow. You as you leave marks on this world, you mark yourself. Probably undignified for a guy my age, but I don't really care. You know, why not? I just don't see my body as that important to really kind of, you know, it's graffiti essentially, you know. Tony was here, or somebody was, you know. Somebody hurt me, somebody showed me something beautiful. Don't want to forget this, whatever.
Anthony, you tell the story of eating vichyssoise on a cruise ship as a kid and getting turned on to food. That experience turned you on to food. I'm wondering how you got interested in writing.
Given two points in my life, I was given a freakish and very fortunate opportunity to write, and I showed up on time and I did it. I've never, all those years cooking, I wasn't sitting around writing unpublished manuscripts. In fact, you know, I ain't bragging or anything, but I've never written anything that hasn't been published. And generally, I get the, you know, and I'm not writing on spec either. I don't have time. I never had the time. I wasn't like I was sitting around writing. I kind of always liked the idea of being a writer. You know, writers got to wear, you know, silk smoking jackets, smoke opium, and score with, you know, kooky, you know, of the sexually ambiguous women in black turtlenecks. And that sounded like hot.
So you're cooking all day and then writing all night?
No, I cooked all day, woke up early, and I'd write for a couple of hours before I went to work. I'm smartest in the fastest in the morning. I get progressively slower and stupider after that. And if I don't write in the morning, I'm not writing. I did that for about 9 months, you know, while I was writing Kitchen Confidential, and Bone in the Throat and Gone Bamboo. Same thing. In Cook's Tour, I took a month and a half off, 2 months in the Caribbean. You know, I'd be keeping notes while I was on the road and writing, you know, on planes and in hotels and things like that, or when I was back in New York between shows. And then I took a month and a half off and did a rewrite, you know, put it together. It takes me about 8 months almost every day to you know, for the whole, you know, all the, for two drafts of a book, you know.
And are you working on anything now?
Yeah, a novel. fourth crime novel. Yeah, it's a therapy for me. Back in the day when I started cooking, you know, the boss, the major investors, the people who brought your meat, took out your trash, you know, delivered your fish, they were all from the entertainment and financial services sector, shall we say. After the novel, it's the Asia book, I hope. It's going to be about me living in Asia, and eating and whatever else happens. No more cookbooks I've done. You know, I'm really proud of the cookbook, but it's done. You know, I put it all down, and there ain't no more.
That's Anthony Bourdain from the Rain Coast Books podcast from 2006. Thanks also to Manik Sherritt for helping put this particular podcast into context. And there are some pictures from that day on the website if you want to check those out. That's at www.podcasthouse.ca. I'll be featuring more podcasts from my vault in future episodes. In the meantime, I'm Robert Wiemat. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Big Snit Media in Vancouver.